Hello everyone and welcome to episode 4 of Lur and Longboy Liberty, also known as Gabriel and Nick.
Yeah, how's it?
So we here today are going to continue our tradition of talking about things that are very relevant to South Africa and topical, by of course talking about the most topical thing at the moment, which is that it's the, how many year anniversary of the
101.
Treaty?
101.
The 101 anniversary of the Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah, no relation to us guys, promise.
Promise, except maybe, you know. You know that smart minds can draw comparisons.
Yeah.
But we'll get there. So it was on the 28th of June, yes?
Mm.
In 1918, that the Treaty of Versailles was signed, ending the war between the powers in the First World War. It was Germany's surrender, basically, at the end there.
Yeah.
And it's generally been considered to be one of the greatest failures in world diplomatic history.
Yeah, so there's this story about, I think that most people have in their minds when they think about it, though they don't think about it too much, is that the Treaty of Versailles was a diplomatic catastrophe. It was too punitive. It set Germany up to fail. And then when Germany did fail, because it had been bullied into this position.
We got it wrong. It is the 100 year.
It's the centenary.
Yes,
it's the big one.
That's why we're talking about this. We know what we're doing.
We know exactly what we're doing. This is 100 years since the worst deal in history.
The worst deal.
Worst deal.
The worst deal.
There's never been such a bad deal.
So why was it such a terrible deal?
Well, the general line is that reparations were so extremely expensive, there's no way that the Germans could pay them back, so that tanked the economy. And then when people suddenly get very poor, in conjunction with that, the military was forced to be small and no air force allowed and very little shipping and so on.
It destroyed their economy and made them resentful.
So yeah, so it makes them angry, and then they say, well, what we need to do is rebuild our military. We need to retake the little bit of land that we lost and take lots more land and punish all of these French people that have tried to punish us and rule the world. And fascism is kind of born from the ashes of the German catastrophe of the 1920s, and the German catastrophe of the 1920s is directly to the root cause of that is 1919 Treaty of Versailles.
So what's interesting is that this is actually the line I think that John Maynard Keynes made popular.
Yeah.
Because he wrote a influential piece of writing just after the treaty was signed, in which he put forward many of these arguments. And he also said that
he stormed out. He stormed out. He was at the Treaty of Versailles. Yeah. He stormed out.
And he famously said that this isn't a peace treaty, is an armistice for 20 years, which proved to be very accurate.
Yeah. So Keynes was right about that. I think that he was wrong about some of it, though.
Yeah. So we've discussed this before, but one of the arguments he put forward is that the treaty was unduly harsh on Germany and that it was truly crippling. Some historians have argued that the Treaty of Versailles was less harsh than the Franco-Prussian Wars Treaty, which is in the 1870s, which had been part of the establishment of Germany as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reparations and the territorial losses and stuff were actually much more brutal on Germany after the end of that war.
On France. France suffered much worse.
Got
a much worse deal in 1872, I think it was, than Germany got in 1919.
Yeah.
That's one important factor. Another important factor is if you look at the treaties that the Germans, some of the German diplomats and military figures had been thinking of what kind of treaty they'd like to force upon their enemies.
Yes.
Because in the last stages of, in sort of the summer of 1918, the Germans come up with the stormtrooper tactic of sort of rapid artillery barrages with stormtroopers going at the same time, raiding them at night. It kind of changed the deadlock of trench warfare in World War One. They were making radical ground.
It looked like they might be able to break the Allies before the American army arrived.
If the Americans hadn't come in so quick, they came in quicker than expected, then it looked like they might be able to break the back of the Allies. And so they were starting to think, what kind of treaty will we force upon these Allies? And those treaties that they were drafting were more harsh than the Treaty of Versailles.
They were, they were terribly harsh. I mean, they would see Germany being the super behemoth with the Netherlands, which was a completely neutral country, locked in perpetual economic union with them. Belgium the same, or possibly even being annexed by Germany. So it was the Germans, compared to what they were planning for their opponents, they got off quite lightly.
And then of course the last one is that there was one major ally that did drop out of the war, that did in a sense lose the war, and that was Russia. And in a lot of ways, Germany helped that, partly by killing a lot of Russians and also by funneling Lenin from Switzerland into Moscow at the right time, because there was the Russian Revolution of February 1917, where the communists come to power, but they don't pull out of the war.
And the other interesting thing about that is the Bolsheviks actually received some funding directly from the Imperial German government.
Yes, the German government is yeah.
This is all part of my thesis that Imperial Germany is the villain of the last 200 years.
Well, we're gonna look at that a little bit carefully.
We'll argue about
that later. But the treaty that they forced on Russia, having sort of set up this puppet government in some senses, I mean, I think Lenin genuinely believed what he believed and was happy to take money from anyone in order to get it. He wasn't a faker.
What was the famous line of the Bolsheviks? We'll hang the capitalists with the rope they sell us.
Yes, there we go. But certainly the Germans helped him get there, and then when it was time to sue for peace, they forced upon them a deal in which the sort of amount of money extracted and the amount of territory seized on the eastern border of Germany. They took Poland basically,
and the whole of Ukraine, I think, was also supposed to.
Yeah,
be part
so
of
they took like 40% of Russian industry, 50% of Russian industry, 40% of agriculture. You know, just absurdly high figures.
Yeah.
Much more harsh than the Treaty of Versailles. So in these senses, the Treaty of Versailles wasn't nearly so harsh. There's another sense in which it wasn't nearly so harsh, which was that it wasn't enforced quite quickly. Various of the Allied powers stopped demanding reparations. This is partly because the Germans were inflating their currency in order to, you know, pay them in worthless marks, and that was starting to cripple the... Well, there's almost no point collecting those marks then. But they also could see that there was a genuine need to kind of be flexible about that.
Yes.
And maybe that was a good thing, but then there was also great flexibility in terms of the military strictures imposed in the Treaty of Versailles. The Germans weren't allowed to occupy the Ruhr.
Yeah, the Rhineland.
The Rhineland. When they did, the French army outnumbered the German army something like 17 to 1. They could have invaded and put an end to it, but they didn't because they were
timid. The French had actually invaded in, I think, the 20s, and they'd occupied the Rhineland and the Ruhr, but there was a very successful strike by German workers,
yes,
which basically pushed the French out. But that was them trying to enforce the treaty, and after that, there was the enforcement of the treaty really started to kind of just fade away.
Yeah, so the Germans were kind of building a secret army, accepting it was no real secret.
As Winston Churchill famously was brought to the attention of the British Parliament many a time.
Mm. And they were also building an air force, largely by getting Germans to buy Volkswagen. You sort of pay for your car now and you'll get it once you build a factory, but in fact all the money goes to building Luftwaffe.
And they were developing new tank technologies in the Soviet Union, interestingly.
Mm.
What people often forget about the Second World War is that for a lot of the 30s and right up until 1941, the Germans and the Soviets were basically the same team.
Yeah,
and they were viewed as the same team by people at the time.
Inside, von Ribbentrop, Molotov pact signed between the German and Soviet foreign secretaries basically solidifies that relationship and also carves apart Poland. They don't exactly invade at the same time, but their agreement that they're going to take this land between them and carve it between each other is made very explicitly.
And Stalin would call Hitler and say, "I want to take this area," and Hitler would say, "Okay, you can take
this.
Yeah,
you can have this. Here. Give me that." Yeah.
Exactly. It was a very. They of course didn't. Both sides knew that it was very temporary in a certain sense.
Yeah.
But they also were. I mean, there were Soviet supplies going to the Germans right up, I think, until the day of the invasion.
Mm. Yeah, and the Soviets were shocked when it came. And the Americans weren't totally clean. There was I was speaking to someone on Wednesday who was referring me to a book that I haven't read myself, but the claim sort of being made there was that a lot of German steel was being imported from America during the Nazi regime as they were building. You know, where did the steel come from to build the submarines and the Luftwaffe and the tanks? A lot of it came from the States. Big part of the reason that they wanted to keep a hands-off approach to this. FDR's diplomats that he sent to Berlin were some of the worst diplomats in the entire American service, completely silly in some of the periods and appeasing and so on.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
We are getting ahead of ourselves because I think
what's crucial about Versailles? Why did it fail if it wasn't that harsh?
Right. So I think it failed because it wasn't enforced on the military side. the German militarism was not contained while it was still small. The idea is you destroy the big machine, and then when it's small, if it starts rising up, you can crush it before
easily again. Yes,
easily again, and that didn't happen. But the other sense in which it failed, so that's sort of after the fact, though. That's ex post. There's something about the treaty itself that was a profound failure, in my opinion. And that was the guilt clause, the famous guilt clause. Because by the time you get to the treaty, there's already been an armistice for about 6 months. There's been very little fighting. There's been no fighting.
Yeah.
And a lot of troops from America have gone home, and the Germans are starting to get a bit tired, but they start wondering maybe if we could whip something up.
And there's been a fair amount of chaos in Germany at the time as well.
Yeah.
Because right after the war, the thing began falling apart.
Yeah. And you deposition of the Kaiser, which was kind of one of the preconditions of the thing, kind of changes the political environment a lot. You've got these, the Weimar Republic is sort of declared to exist by someone shouting out of the window, "By the way, we have become a republic." And someone says, "Oh, okay." And then they're like, "Well, it's official now."
Yeah, and there was a communist rebellion.
Communist rebellions, mass strikes. It really was a very chaotic time.
And Europe was just tired.
Europe was exhausted, but crucially, Hindenburg, the chief general, Ludendorff, his right-hand man, and Gruner was another important role player. They all knew that once the Americans had come in, the equation had changed. They weren't able to import anymore. There was complete Allied supremacy in the seas. So they were locked in terms of supplies and trade and food and petrol, and they had run out of men, numbers.
Before the Americans arrived in force in that last successful offensive, or mildly successful offensive, they had already begun to have doubts that they could win the war, because they had had this brilliant new tactic. They were gaining some ground for the first time in a long time. It was the first time they'd been on offensive for almost the entire...
Since the beginning.
And they just, even though the British and the French were battered and kept making mistakes, they just didn't break through.
Yeah.
They got close, but they just couldn't break it.
Yeah.
And they knew then that it was too late. That was the last gasp.
That was their last gasp. And they asked
the government that they for an armistice.
Exactly. So the general said to the government, "Please, we need an armistice." And the general said to the government, "We need a peace treaty.
We cannot win. The army is like 2 weeks from disintegrating."
Exactly. The mass defections are starting to happen. Yeah. They were worried about that taking over. So the thing is, they were in such a weak position that when they got to the treaty table, when they got to Versailles and they had to sign the deal, they were willing to swallow the tough reparations. They were willing to swallow the sort of no man's land zones that they weren't ever allowed to send a military to. They were willing to swallow the necessity to reduce the tonnage of their naval force. They were willing to commit to never creating an air force. They were willing to reduce the size of their army. They were ready to take the hit.
On the naval front, there was treaties signed afterwards where all the major powers agreed that they were going to limit the number of ships they had.
Yeah,
tonnage,
stop the arms race. But so there was just one clause. At the end of it, there was one clause that they said, "We cannot reasonably sign this. This is crazy. You can't do this." And this was the German war guilt clause. And this clause said, "We, the undersigned German people representatives, declare that we were solely responsible for this nihilistic, catastrophic, terrible, terrible war.
This disaster which has destroyed Europe."
And it's such an interesting thing because it's not about military, it's not about power.
Yeah.
It's not about economics. It's just about prestige. Yes. It's just about the sense of German guilt, about the sense of French excellence, about the sense of the Russians not really having a role to play, about the sense of the Austro-Hungarians kind of getting a free pass.
Yes.
It's just about, should you as a German person feel guilty for the deaths of your own citizens, of the foreign citizens, of the destruction of the economies, the misery of the people that have gone through?
So I would like to say at this point that for our purposes here, what's particularly important is not necessarily whether they were mostly responsible or not.
Right, right.
You and I have differing views on that.
We do.
I tend to think that Germany does bear some of the blame. You think Russia is more to blame?
Well, I think we agree that they didn't bear sole responsibility.
Yes, no.
And the problem with making them declare sole responsibility, which is really something that the French demanded more than anyone else.
Whether it was true or not.
Well, no, I think it's important that they didn't, that it's not true that they bore sole responsibility, because once you are forced to sign up for a lie, it changes everything. It changes the concept of what it is to be a German, because either as a German you have to sign on to that lie and say we really are guilty, Or
we're just the worst.
And say, yeah, say that we're the worst, you know, slap ourselves on the back with a cat and nine tails. Or you set up the playing field for someone to say, we've been bullied into taking sole responsibility for something that is more complicated than that.
Yes.
And we've been bullied by foreign forces that actually do not have our interests at heart. Foreign forces that do not see us as people. They just see us as purely evil.
Yes.
And that became a self-fulfilling prophecy. The German state did become purely evil. It became the Nazi state, but it became the Nazi state on the back of a Nazi movement that said, we were forced to take the blame for this war, and yet the blame was not solely ours.
And we're also great, and we're not just great, we're the greatest people in the world.
So that, I think, that paying attention to one's sense of national pride is important, and it does make me want to tell a brief story about the build-up to World War One. And the story is about the build-up to World War One being such that the Treaty of Versailles is not an end to World War One, as you say. It's just another move in World War One, and World War Two being another move in World War One, because the same basic problems don't really go away, and those problems are a profoundly wicked way of thinking of national pride.
Yes.
And so the story is really told, I think, best by Dominic Lievin. Professor Dominic Lievin, he's a Don at Cambridge historian, and he's focused on Slavic history all his life. He's an old man now. And his latest book, I think it still is, although it was written a few years ago, is called Towards the Flame, and it's an analysis of the causes of World War One. And he certainly, I don't want to make the mistake here of making it seem like he thinks, or making it seem like I think, this is all the Russians' fault.
Yeah.
But he does make the case for why we should think of the Russian role more often than we do. And he starts out by making a very interesting point. If you were to go to the coal mines of Wales, or the fisheries of Scotland, where men were being drafted, or the sort of vineyards of France, and you ask them, are you going now to fight a war over some part of the Balkans, over whether Bulgaria is going to fit into this country or that country,
and whether Bosnia is a part of Serbia, and
none of them would say yes. In fact, many of them would ask you what you're talking about. Yeah. Where they wouldn't be able to put those things on a map, if they didn't.
Yeah, Britain had no quarrel with Austria-Hungary, really.
So, and yet the war really does start there. I mean, literally with Princip killing Archduke Franz Ferdinand. But the way that the war was taught to me at school was a little bit like, this is an accidental thing, and then you've got the system of alliances that collapses itself as a result. But Lievin's point is slightly deeper. He attends to a broader trend in history, something that we as South Africans could obviously bear no relation to. Decolonization. He notices that Europe was colonized in a sense. It thought of itself as Christendom, was colonized by Dar al-Islam from the Iberian coast, from all the way to the most western parts of Europe and Spain and Portugal, through to the east, up to Vienna.
Yes.
There was, Dar al-Islam was there.
The Ottoman Empire.
There were various iterations, actually. I mean, sometimes there were splits and then reunifications and suzerainties.
There had been Islamic forces in Europe in various guises, starting with the Umayyads, I believe, or the first Islamic caliphate to enter Spain.
Yeah.
When the Byzantines collapse in the sort of 1300s, that's when the Ottomans cross into mm-hmm. The Balkans. So there had been this feeling around Christian Europe that they were under siege. And that's one of the things that provokes the Crusades in the Middle Ages.
Exactly. The Crusades are this organized effort to say, although we belong to different monarchic political units, there's something bigger that unites us all.
Yes.
And really, it is more religion than race.
Yes.
But as time goes by, we'll start to see how race becomes more important.
More racialized, and Christendom starts to be dropped in favor of race.
Of whiteness.
Yes.
And so this decolonization project, decolonization is something we think of as South Africa. I think whether or not we like the tactics of the Fallists and of the academics and of the sort of various political players that push this idea. I think we generally, there's a sentiment in South Africa that I detect of thinking, well, it's a good project to pursue. You just need to use the right means to do it. And yet there's a very important cautionary tale here that comes out of the last moments when it really works. When it's sort of half working, you've got these battles between two groups, and it's a nasty thing, but it's hard to say one side's wrong, it's hard to say one side's right, and there are certainly useful things that come out of it. The Crusaders do completely awful, inhumane things. On the other hand, some parts of the Crusaders develop a postage network and a system of transferring money and foreign banking and stuff that's really good for economic growth. Likewise, in Dar al-Islam, there's some kind of...
there's some places, there was, I think, a few cities that were majority Jewish, actually.
Yeah, they're hugely tolerant.
They were filled with Jews that were exiled from Isabella, Spain.
Exactly.
But in other cases, they practiced a system of religious slavery where every Christian boy in the Balkans basically could be handed over as a Janissary and castrated. So
yeah.
So there are ups and downs.
So there are ups and downs for sure. But then when the project... The problem is when you've got a battle and then victory turns out to be kind of the worst thing, because victory in the great decolonization of whiteness or of Europeness or of Christendom is when the sick man of Europe, as it was called, the Ottoman Empire, finally just cannot afford to maintain the hold over its, let's call them colonies, its hold on the Balkans.
It's Western provinces, yeah.
And then Austro-Hungary and Russia both are looking at these last pockets of formerly colonized land, and they say, this is the blood of our soil that was shed on this land when the colonists first came, and it is therefore our soil by blood to reclaim.
The Habsburg, the Austro-Hungarians can say, we've been fighting the Ottomans for centuries. This is our natural thing. We're the descendants of this great empire that's defended Christendom. And the Russians are saying, these are Slavic brothers.
Exactly. And what is most interesting about Levin's analysis, in my view, is who of the Russians are saying that. Because the Tsar, the thing that binds Russia and the thing that binds Austro-Hungary is the Tsar and the Emperor. They are multi-ethnic political states.
Yes.
They are about as multi-ethnic as it's a cosmopolitan melting pot,
yep.
Sort of very much of the flavor that we look up to today.
Yes.
Vienna, St. Petersburg, these are places where you hear many different languages on the streets. There's many different ethnicities being present.
Famously, the Austro-Hungarian army often had problems because its officers would speak different languages to its troops.
This is an interesting problem to have. This sounds like such a 21st century problem.
Yeah.
And that's because the 20th century was so defined by race ethnic states. But what came before race ethnic states were these grand monarchic empires where the thought was, as long as you're loyal
to the sovereign,
then it doesn't really matter what you look like, what you sound like, you can kind of get along.
Yeah, there's actually an interesting South African example of that, which is in the sort of late 1800s, the British Cape government attempted to disarm the Basutu as part of various campaigns to disarm black Africans. And one of the things that the Basutu appealed to, they said, but we're British subjects, which means we're subject to the Queen's laws and justice, and we need trials, and we have the rights of British citizens, and we are free men, and that includes the right to bear arms.
And the same, and Sol Plaatje makes the same argument in the ANC with the Land Act at the beginning of sort of the Union of South Africa under the British flag, and they say, no, but I want to go and ask the king, how you can possibly allow this kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
The trouble is that by this stage, across Europe, race thinking has replaced religious grouping and has started to push aside the kind of thought that it's the loyalty to the sovereign that holds the country together. Instead, it's the loyalty to a blood right, and often a blood right to a particular parcel of land.
To have a sort of, they're like an organic object.
It's a metaphysical entity. Yes. It's something that is in the world as fundamentally as the sun and the moon, and you better attend to it. And this is the natural unit of selection, in fact. It's races that compete, and one race will ultimately win.
So when we're talking about other countries, we tend to not draw too many comparisons to South Africa. It's very important. But I think maybe we should perhaps
draw a comparison to South African. Yeah. So, okay, I want to draw the following comparison just by completing the point of who it was in Russia that was making the biggest noises. And yes. Dominik Lievin's point is that it wasn't the Tsar, it wasn't the Tsar's government insofar as he had a parliament, it wasn't them either. It was the newspaper men. And yes, they were men.
That sounds a little bit familiar, actually.
And what had happened is that in the 1870s, more or less, hot metal, which radically changed the printing press, new technologies came in that allowed mass production at a much cheaper rate on much cheaper paper of information, of text. And it was a disruption as great as the disruption, I think, of the social media today.
Exactly.
And of radio in its time to come.
Exactly.
And the people who took charge of those platforms, they said, don't look east, which is where Russian expansionism had been going. Don't look south towards the stands, which is where Russian expansionism had going and where they were thinking of extending their infrastructure and their education and their manufacturing. They said instead, look to the Slavic lands in the Balkans, because these people are the same race as us, because we need to decolonize them from the Ottomans, and we need to make sure that they are not overwhelmed by the Austrians, and we as a race must hold together. And it's under exactly that ideology that Gavrilo Princip shoots Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He wants to unite South Slavia. Now, I don't want to draw any comparisons to South Africa, but the words are the same. Slavia, yes. And Africa. Africa today, in many people's mouths, means a race, just as Slavia means a race. And one of the terrible things about the way that we forget European history is that Slav was a race, Gael was a race, Frank or Gaul was a race, Teuton or Aryan was a race, Anglo-Saxon was a race. These white was not quite the race that we think of it as today. Yes. There were genuine racial distinctions. Now we just call them ethnic distinctions. And the Slavic, the Pan-Slavism, it was called, is much like Pan-Africanism today. And when Kwame Anthony Appiah, in my view, the greatest living philosopher on race, says that Pan-Africanism is the thing keeping racism alive in politics more than anything else, in international politics, I hear an echo from a century ago, when Pan-Slavism was the number one thing, because a new technology in a country that was economically backward and struggling and had an illegitimate government that was completely inept and falling upon itself. Alexander III, not unlike Zuma, was had too many mistresses and couldn't really do much
there
useful.
There was general incompetence in the government.
And so people needed something new to bind them together, something new to think about, and Pan-Slavism was it then, and Pan-Africanism is a very potent force today.
Yes.
And it's a great worry, and it's a particularly great worry because it goes unquestioned, as does the project of decolonization. Exactly. It goes unquestioned.
I think what's also interesting about this point is the role of sort of media elites, in that they are very invested in these types of narratives. So in South Africa, we have so many examples of this, of how we put out our Hope Report, which shows that generally people are actually kind of, South Africans get along with each other or have positive views of each other. And yet we have a media elite that is so excited to just drive these narratives of this like oppressor and oppressed all the time. It just never stops. And there's kind of cheerleading for the EFF in headlines. I saw a headline recently. It said how this EFF, young EFF MP's maiden speech won the hearts of South Africans.
Mm.
I mean, okay.
Yeah, there's a crowd full of people who dig it.
Yeah, there are some people who like it, but I don't see how that's the hearts of South Africans.
And the great warning, I think, that Lievin speaks to of what happened 100 years ago, 105 years ago, is that there were a million little villages in Russia. Russia then, as now, is a lot like South Africa. Big cities, heavily industrialized, heavily financed. Russian bonds were the big things to buy back in the day because the interest rates were so high because no one was sure entirely whether they could pay back the bonds. So it was like a good investment if you had a high risk appetite, much like sort of it would be to buy Eskom or South African equities. But in those million little villages, people didn't even know what a German was. People did not identify themselves as Slavs. People identified themselves as Orthodox Christians,
yes,
or as what, syncretic Christians. They sort of had these cow leather bands that they would wear around their waists to protect, yes, them from the tokoloshis that used to live in the banyas, in the baths and so on, in the forests and in the fields. they weren't interested. But when the time came to muster an army, they still knew about the Tsar, and they still knew about this ancient organizing principle of their society, and so they stood up, and they went off
in their millions.
In their millions to die. And it was the media elites in the cities who were arguing precisely that it was in those villages' interests, because it was the people off in the village that were the truest Slavs.
Yes. Pure Slavs.
They were because they had the same old rituals as yesteryear, and they wore the same old dress, and they sang the same old songs, and it was for them that the land was being fought.
They were unpolluted by the German modern world.
And yes, the cosmopolitan sort of habits like smoking cigarettes and drinking cocktails. And
pollution from the outside.
Yes, reading novels and stuff like that. And truly great people fell. I mean, one of the saddest things is Fyodor Dostoevsky, I think, is one of the greatest writers of the 19th century, of any century. And he wrote with a profound insight into the lives of working class and poor people, of prostitutes and beggars that really downtrodden. And he lived with them because he was poor often and schizophrenic and he had epileptic fits and was... Even he bowed down to this pan-Slavic nationalist rhetoric. By the time he was 70, the year before he dies, he gets invited to make a speech on Pushkin's anniversary, the Shakespeare of Russia, and he stands up and sort of speaks to pan-Slavic values. Yeah. And for the first time, he says, I am recognized. For the first time, he says, I am loved. Why? Because in the elite circles, this was exactly what they were hoping this kind of respectable, earthy writer would say. And in South Africa, I see a little bit of a shift in the tone from the Zuma era to the Ramaphosa era, but something that doesn't seem to have changed is a fixation with the African identity and with the South African black identity. And one of the questions is, do we have a military problem that we're facing as a result? I think the answer is no. But does that mean, just because we don't have an elite that can muster 20 million South Africans to go march off into a war against America in Venezuela or whatever, doesn't mean that we're off the hook?
Yeah, no, because here our race warriors have the luxury of not having to invade another country to find the enemy, because the enemy lives amongst us or amongst them. I think this is something we this is kind of why we have this silly joke about you know, not comparing the international to South Africa too much, is because South Africans do have this blindness to how so many of the problems we face now, whether they be to do with race, whether they be to do with economics or policy, we can draw lessons from other parts of the world. You can look at affirmative action laws in Malaysia. You can look at the destructiveness of pan-Slavic or pan-German nationalism in the First World War and the Second World War. Mm. And there are key lessons to be drawn here, but we just, for some reason, are really reluctant to see them as applicable to us. As though South Africa was the beginning and the end of time, as though oppression is invented in South Africa, as though the struggle against colonial power was invented in South Africa. We're all part of a much greater trends in human psychology, in human behavior. Why do you think we're so desperate to avoid these comparisons to overseas?
Yeah, I think, I'll tell you the truth. I think it's because
you haven't until now been.
No, I've been telling the truth, but I think the honest answer to that question is uncomfortable. I think that it is because the flavor of fascism that we've had fascism here, but the kind that we had was profoundly different to what happened in Nazi Germany, for one. And let me just make it clear that the Russians, when they started to get going with their pan-Slavic attitudes, I don't want to make it out to be the case that all of the peasants and all of the working class were perfectly innocent. As always, almost, the first target to hand is the one that faces the greatest brunt, as you said, and the first target to hand was the Jews.
Yes.
And the pogroms in Russia were, there was an elitist quality to the program there, and there was a very peasant and working class sort of enthusiasm for that project in those areas.
Yes.
So if you look at the quantity, if you look at the quality of oppression that took place across history in other places, I think one finds oneself in the awkward position of, if one is making the comparison, saying that the last 100 years, South Africa has been a horrendously oppressive place to the majority of its people. Mm. But, this terrible word, but not at the same magnitude. Not as many people were killed. We haven't had a gulag. We haven't had gas chambers. We didn't have conflicts where millions of people were digging their own graves in trenches and then dying. Yeah. And so I think it's very difficult for us to bring the world into South Africa in a comparative analogous way, because it undermines our sense of being distinguished by having had the worst form of oppression on earth.
Yes.
When in fact what we had is one of the longest lasting, or at least one of the latest iterations,
yeah,
of oppressive race nationalism. That's really where we distinguish ourselves, is that we kept the bloody project up for so long.
Exactly. That's the thing, is the longevity of our oppressive project. But people don't like to hear that, because there's a sort of need in our public discourse, and this isn't just in South Africa, it's everywhere, because I think it's a facet of human nature,
yeah,
that we don't want to see the gradations. People think that if you say apartheid wasn't as bad as Tsarist Russia, that means that you're claiming that apartheid is good.
No, yeah, that is what people think.
Which is, yeah, it's what people think, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Two things can be bad.
Yeah.
But one thing can be worse than another.
Yeah, and just because it wasn't the worst thing doesn't mean that it
wasn't an evil.
That it wasn't an evil. That it's that never again shouldn't apply. And one of the problems with never again is that it is, in my view, never again is the greatest slogan of the 20th century. It is the slogan that is being chanted on the streets of London and Manchester and Liverpool when the war comes to a close. It is this chant that is rippling across Poland and the Balkans and parts of northern Italy. Never again. And we signed the treaty, and then it happened again. In fact, it wasn't over to begin with,
yeah,
because we didn't learn the lesson. And in South Africa, I worry that our never again, it rings even more, it's got a, yes, more tinny quality. It doesn't feel like a substantive, full-throated conviction in the minds of South Africans that we cannot do this ever again.
Well, I mean, I think people interpret never again in a different way in the South African context, in that never again to us.
Mm. And that's exactly what they started to think in Germany in the 20s.
Exactly.
And that's exactly the problem.
So I think this is what we would call a good note to end.
Okay.
So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can join as a friend of the Institute of Race Relations if you like the work that we're doing. You just need to SMS your name to 32823. Terms and conditions apply, and SMSs cost 1 rand. And we'll see you on the next episode of Learn Long Boy Liberty. Mm-hmm. Have a good one, guys.